Before we get started today, I want to remind you that my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is now available on DVD. Here's how you get it. You go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, click on the videos page, there it is. Click on that, take you to PayPal, Bob's your uncle. Buy several, won't you? You know Christmas is coming up, come on. Perfect Christmas gift. Or as we like to say in our family, stocking stuffer. Thank you.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 54 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. Normally, I'm a jet, and a jet all the way from my first cigarette to my last dying day. But today, I'm running with the sharks. My guest is the great George Chakiris. Now, this is a huge deal for me, perhaps in terms of just sheer awestruck star power, maybe the biggest deal of my commentary track history. I became, obsessed is not too strong a word, with West Side Story when I was a child. And here's the weird thing. I became obsessed with it before I even saw it. As a matter of fact, I didn't see it for years. I heard the album, I guess. And so I listened to the soundtrack, and then I was just about, that was about the time I was starting to take piano lessons. So I got the sheet music and would grab at any chance I could to look at pictures from it. I got the novelization and read and reread that. And I'm talking about being in about the fifth grade. And then the apex of that obsession came when still, I'm talking fifth grade here, I went to a pawn shop in Anderson, South Carolina, and bought a switchblade, which I kept with me for several years. Never got into a rumble under the freeway, but there was a time when that would have seemed like a good thing to do. That movie was incredibly inspiring to me even before I saw it. And the music is enduringly great, so I've seen it several times. And luckily, since I moved to Los Angeles, the 70mm print has been restored. It was years before I was able to see it in 70mm, and now I've seen it five or six times, I guess. The American Cinematheque has shown it several times at both the Egyptian Theater and the Aero Theater, and almost every time it shows up, I show up too, because seeing this thing in the way it was intended to be seen is an experience you will never forget. If you've only watched it on your TV, man, you have not seen that movie. We were talking about West Side Story even before I got my recorder set up. And so that's the first topic, and we go over it. I finally got to find out several things that I've always wondered about it. As I'm sure I've mentioned on this podcast too many times for most of you, I did write a book about Robert Wise, and I will not dare to say that I was friends with Robert Wise, but we were friendly, and I knew him and interviewed him several times and so forth, and I was always proud to know him. And so listening to George Chakiris talk about what it was like being on the set with Robert Wise as opposed to being on the set with Jerome Robbins, who was Wise's co-director and, of course, the choreographer and the man who directed the stage versions, it was pretty enlightening for me, and it was very, very interesting. I will say one little bit of warning is toward the end of the interview, I mentioned that he's going to be honored at a UCLA event, an evening with George Chakiris, in which they were going to show Young Girls of Rochefort. And in fact, because of when I recorded this, which was just a week ago, that event was last night. So you will hear us talk about it a little bit, but it's no longer in the future. It already happened. If you're going to rush out and buy a ticket to it, I'm so sorry. It's just weird timing. I've been trying to get this thing together for several months, and because he has a very busy schedule and travels a lot and is always in demand all over the place, then it just was not easy for us to nail this down, but we finally did, and I couldn't be more tickled. So, I hope you enjoyed this talk with George Chakiris, and I'll see you on the other side. Well, I'm curious, because you played in the London stage production as Riff, so you're in a particularly good position to talk about the differences in choreography for the stage, and then when it was translated to the screen, because the film is incredibly cinematic and the camera is always moving, but the dance is always moving with the camera. So could you talk a little bit about that? Did you have to relearn the movements a little bit?
No, the choreography for the film was basically the same as it was in the theater, except, for example, in the America number, because the guys were added to the America number, so that was additional choreography there. That was different. What the girls did was relatively the same as in the theater. The prologue, of course, well, there was a lot more going on in the prologue cinematically but the steps, the choreography, were basically that same, I'll say the same, but with additional stuff added, because you could run down a street, there's so much more you could do, and that they did do. But the rumble was exactly the way it was staged for the theater as well. So most of that stayed the same, unless they added something. You know, they did, of course, for the prologue, you know, they said, you know, climbing walls or going down the streets, and the fact of doing it in the on location on the streets was such a great thing for the film. But the dance at the gym, that's the same choreography as well, so nothing changed there. So choreographically speaking, there was a material added, but the rest of it pretty much stayed as it was in the theater.
Was it at all challenging to switch roles, since you obviously knew the riff part very well?
No, it wasn't, and I think the reason it wasn't is because I did it for a year and a half in London, and Kendall Roy, the original Bernardo, who's just fantastic, I was opposite him every night for a year and a half, so you become familiar with all the characters without even trying to. It's kind of like an osmosis kind of thing. So, it was kind of a nice transition, you know, or a nice change, because, I kind of had best of both worlds, in the sense that in the theater version, riff is a better role, because he sings cool. In the film version, he does Officer Krupke with the guys, but he does cool. And in the film version, the role of Bernardo, there's a little bit more meat on the bones, because he has a couple of scenes with Natalie, and being added to the America number and so on. Riff was great in the theater, and Bernardo was just great in the film. You know, you having been around Jerry for as long as we did too, we were everything felt
good. Now, Jerome Robbins directed the stage version himself, didn't he?
Right, he did. Yeah.
So he not only choreographed it, but he directed the whole thing.
Right, he staged, choreographed, and directed the theater version. Yeah, and he directed until he was gone. He directed the film version too. He was the one who was on the floor with us.
Yeah.
Bob Wise, because he was the man who knew film. Was kind of, I always think of him as the father figure back here, who was watching everything. But Jerry was the one who was with us on the floor and would say something if he needed to. Yeah.
So after Jerome Robbins left, how did that change the dynamic of what was going on in the set? I mean, everybody knew the choreography, I guess, but was there tension then, or?
Well, no, first of all, the respect and love for Jerry I mean, it's not just me personally, but I think was, even when he was not there, was very much present. And because we had rehearsed everything before they ever started filming, that was in place, like rehearsal for a theater, for the theater. I remember, I don't remember what we were filming, but one night I was back at my apartment, and Robert Relier, who was Bob's assistant director, he said, we're changing, we're not going to continue with what we were doing, we're going to go into the drugstore tomorrow. So none of us thought, okay. So, you know, get up the next day, get ready and go to work and so on, and sitting around waiting to shoot. And Russ came up to me and he said, "Hey, Jerry's been fired." I couldn't believe it, but he kind of said it eagerly. I couldn't believe my ears, that was that's what happened. I think, again, Jerry's presence was there all the time. It really was, because it was he's the one that we rehearsed with every day, and as I say, he's the one who basically was on the floor, so to speak, with us until he was gone. And Bob Wise's directing style, he was a wonderful, wonderful filmmaker, but as a director, he didn't say anything to anybody. When we were doing the drugstore scene, one of the breaks, we were sitting around to something be relit or whatever, and I was thinking about what I was doing or hadn't been doing or something, and I went up to him and I said, I just feel I could be doing more. And he said, "Well, yes, you could." That was it. Say anything unkind about Bob, because he was fantastic. He's such a lovely man. He's absolutely wonderful. But one of the reasons I say that. I'm sure other people say it too. Now here and there, Jerry, on a couple of occasions, I've heard people say things or something I've read where he isn't getting the credit. it's like he was only there for 2 days. Absolutely not true. They were, I think, when they made, Jerry was such a perfectionist. With himself first, I think the reason he finally had to go, so to speak, was because he was taking too long. But they had so much in the can, so to speak, that it was safe to let him go. There was enough there, and the spirit of it all remained the same. So, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why Bob Wise didn't have to say much. Because it was so in place, and the feeling, and everybody, the girl who played anybody, all of us were, just not set in our ways, but we knew what our job was, and we cared about it so much. So I think that's I never thought of that before. That's a reason why perhaps Bob didn't have to say anything, because we were in place,
Had a lot of people in the film been in stage productions of it? A lot of the dancers, anyway?
Yes, let's see. Eddie Verso, Tony Mordente, David Winters. A number of them were, I would say, at least 10, but something like that. Yes, I'm blanking on his name. Who played Ice, the guy who sings Cool in the film? He's so
Tucker
Smith.
Tucker,
I think, was in the New York production, but he didn't play that role. But he's so so fantastic in the film, you know, and he's such a sweet guy. Cool is was always a wonderful number in the theater, but what Jerry did with it in the film, and having it take place in the garage and the headlights being turned on, and the tension.
That low ceiling.
Yes. And I don't know how, I'm sure Bob, they made those decisions together in terms of where to film it, but Tucker was just so wonderful.
Well, that number in particular is a favorite of mine, uh-huh. just because it is such a cinematic thing, and I love that scene where they all gather at one end and then just start running toward the camera, and the camera is zooming back. And that's just beautiful work.
It is, yeah.
And the choreography throughout. And, yeah. of course, the America number is just a killer.
I love that number, too. Yeah.
Do you remember that screening at the Egyptian Theater? It's got to be 10 or 12 years ago, when almost everybody was there.
Bob was still there.
Robert Relier was there. Walter Mirisch.
Yep, right.
And then in the audience, almost every surviving Jet and Shark were in the audience.
Right, and Bob's wife was there as well. Because they had done the 40th anniversary at Radio City Music Hall. And everybody had such a great time doing that they thought, well, let's do one here, I think. You know, and it was a nice evening.
Well, what was fun for me to watch that was I was sitting up in the balcony that night because it was a packed house.
Uh-huh.
And you would see some dancer that you hadn't seen much before do some kind of flourish, uh-huh. and there'd be a burst of applause right under us. And I thought, oh, he's sitting down there. That guy is right there. He's sitting right under us.
Yeah.
And that was quite a night because Tony Mordente was there. And I think almost everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody alive.
I think that, you're right. The girls
Except
were there.
Richard Baiman.
Yeah, well, Richard.
He never shows up in anything.
Well, it was not a good experience for him. And that in itself is kind of an interesting story. I mean, I think you probably know what it is, but I hate to say anything. I just love Natalie Wood. I mean, she was all of 23 at the time, which is appropriate because she was playing. When she came onto the set, there was a movie star there. You know, it was like, whoa, you know, everybody. But not that she behaved that way. It's just we knew it, you know. But she wanted to replace Richard Beamer with either, I'm not sure who it was, maybe Warren Beatty or her husband. I'm not sure who it was. But so in their scenes together, they never spoke to each other. She never spoke to him. He never spoke to her. And Bob Wise didn't say anything to either of them. I remember some years later, I ran into Richard at the gym, and we sat down for a while. We talked for about an hour. And he said it with no anger, no remorse, nothing like that. But he just said, I could have spoken to her. I mean, so he was thinking back, but in a positive way. And he told me he was calling Sandy Meisner on the phone to try and get help, because he was such a dedicated actor. He's a wonderful actor. I personally think he's fantastic in the film. I just think he's wonderful. And, but it was hard going for him. The first day when Bob Relier called and said, tomorrow we're going to start in the drugstore scene, that was Richard's first time on the set with the camera.
Wow.
No Jerry. So he was never directed by Jerry in the film. And because Bob didn't say anything, he was alone. He was pretty much alone. And must have felt really... Russ tells a story, because they were both in Twin Peaks together.
Yeah.
And there was a gathering of Twin Peaks fans and so on, and then there was a Q&A afterwards, and Russ said somebody asked a question of Richard, and then they asked him a question about West Side Story, and Russ told me, he said, next question.
Wow.
He just, He did come to the 40th anniversary in New York, but that's it. It was, and Elliot Feld was another one. Elliot Feld, for the longest time, evidently Jerry was really hard on him when they were shooting Cool, and I shouldn't laugh. I don't mean to laugh, but it's interesting how, I heard that about Elliot, and Cool was a tough number to film. It was hot, that ceiling was low, and so on. But, and I don't know what Jerry said or did to Elliot or picked on him in some way. And by the way, one of the things that all the guys did when they finished filming Cool, they all took their knee pads and put them in front of Jerry's dressing room door and burned them. Richard just wants nothing to do with it, and I can understand that. I really can understand that, because it was, hey, this major thing, and he was alone. He was just alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It really is too bad, because he's a good actor, and there's other films that he's in where he's terrific. And
you know, there are some people who say, some of the people in the cast as well, or at least a couple, who think he was miscast, and I personally don't think that. I see what he's doing and how wonderful he is, and I see his gift as an actor. Absolutely, I think he's terrific. Yeah.
I thought it was an odd thing, and it was much more a product of its time, that they brought in ghost singers for almost everybody, even people who could sing in the film. Just seemed an odd thing, because I know that a lot of those people can sing well, and yet they were still dubbed by...
Right. Well, Rita sang for herself in the America number, but I think when it came to A Boy Like That, that one, I guess because of the range of it, they did bring in a singer called Betty Wand. Natalie did record... I understand she recorded everything, and
I've heard those recordings.
And I've never heard them, but
she has a perfectly adequate voice. Uh-huh. That's the best you can say.
Right. Yes. Uh-huh.
It she carries a tune, and it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's not what's needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really need a singer for that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Let's see. Tucker Smith, of course. Cool was him. And it was Tucker. I have no idea why they did this, because Russ, in rehearsal when they were doing the Jet song, was just fine. But it was Tucker eventually it's Tucker's voice for Russ when he sings the Jet song. And I never understood that one, because Russ was just fine. But and I think everybody else, let's see, Tony and Maria, everybody else was. I mean. Like in the American number, sometimes people will say, well, did you sing for yourself? And I said, well, yeah, because you didn't really need a real singing voice. Yeah. I like to be in America. You know, that's not much of a challenge. But
yeah.
For Natalie and Rita for that part, and of course Richard, and I think I've forgotten his name. Who sang for Richard? But I think it's a wonderful, wonderful match, you know, and for Natalie too.
Yeah.
Marnie Nixon did a lot of great things in her time, you know. In her time, she's still going. I shouldn't say in her time.
Yeah, she's a wonderful singer, and she's also a wonderful actress.
Yes,
she can sing the songs in the dramatic way that they need to
be
sung. She's really great. Yeah, I've got no objections to almost anything in that film. I love it. How long were you in New York? They made so much about it being shot on location, but actually location wasn't that extensive on this. Just the prologue part is about it all.
The prologue was all that they shot in New York, but that was enough to give it that authentic feel. And you know what? It's really interesting because... dancing on the streets, you know, but the way it's Jerry introduces the movement very, very slowly. They don't start dancing right away. I think the audience is, well, he did it that way in the theater too. Nobody burst out dancing in the prologue right away. It had a cool, soft, not cool, but a thoughtful a beginning that had different levels to it, you know. And then eventually, when the gangs meet each other, then they start. But I think being on of the real locations in New York, there were two locations. I've just tried to think what that what it felt like to us, what it might have felt like to us if it had been on a sound stage. Probably we wouldn't know the difference. It would have felt just fine either way. But the real street, of course, the about that is dancing on pavement. But I never experienced a problem with that too. I think most of the guys did not. But just the reality of because it was real, they were real locations, and all of those buildings came down like the next day or whatever.
Yeah, they were holding the demolition until you could finish shooting.
Okay, right.
Yeah. And they just brought it right down.
Yeah. And then the other location was 110th and 2nd Street. That's the playground.
Mm-hmm.
And they reconstructed. They did the playground in the studio as well, so that it was used in the studio as well.
So the final scene is actually on the
that's
stage.
Right, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Prologue scene. But yeah, that prologue, I love the choreography in that because it really sets up both sides of what is going to of what his choreography was like, which was this kind of cool jazzy look, but also mm-hmm. these broad balletic movements.
Yes.
You know, I think you have what I think of as the iconic moment with you and the other two guys. Okay. With that, you know, one leg up,
yeah.
and the camera is like looking up, and the tenements behind you, and
yeah,
that's like that's the scene that says West Side Story to me.
Well, that photograph is used a lot. The still photograph, and by the way, that's J. Norman and Eddie Verso, they dug a hole. Big square hole for the camera to be in, so yeah. The camera was really low, and and those buildings in the back, that was a beautiful whoever thought of it, I suppose, and I'm sure I'm sure because he's the cinematic person,
yeah.
that was Bob. But
he did well, they built Lincoln Center where that was. I mean, that's pretty much exactly where Lincoln Center is.
That's right, yeah.
So that's why they were tearing all that stuff down to build that up.
To build it, so.
I wonder if West Side Story has ever been shown at Lincoln Center. That would be kind of a circle within a circle, wouldn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, a couple of years ago, maybe not quite that long, you know, they did the concert. The screening at the Hollywood Bowl, but with the orchestra was live, conducted by David Newman. So it was fantastic to hear the music live, but still have it.
Yeah.
But they did that maybe 5 or 6 months later at Lincoln Center and Avery Fisher Hall, that showing the movie with the live orchestra. We went for that too. It was great. Yeah.
Was Bernstein around at all?
No. I wish he had been.
Or Sondheim?
No. No, they weren't. I think any additional... There probably was additional material from Leonard Bernstein, I'm guessing, but I think I'm right. But he was able to do that from New York and not have to be present. I think Stephen Sondheim's... I think his work was pretty much intact. So they weren't around, but we all got to, when we were doing the London company, we all got to meet Leonard Bernstein and his wife one night. But when he and his wife came to see the show, and afterwards we all gathered on stage in a semicircle, and he said hello to us. That was the only time I got to be around Leonard Bernstein, because what a fantastic score. I mean, what an amazing man he is.
Well, that the music in that is one of the great American pieces of concert music.
Absolutely.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
And just the depth and the complexity of it, too. It doesn't sound anything like a musical. It sounds like real music.
In my mind, I've always thought that the passion and the feeling and of that piece comes from the music, from Leonard Bernstein, and from Jerry.
Yeah.
That was, and I think it's, you know, genius is not a word to toss around lightly, but I think it applies to those two men.
Sure does.
Yeah. And an amazing kind of a collaboration to begin with Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, Jerry, Leonard Bernstein, and wow, wonderful. What a combination.
It's like a super group of Broadway.
Yes, absolutely.
Just amazing. And it's interesting to me how many choreographers came out of that. I mean, Tony Mordente and Elliot Feld and David Winters.
Yeah,
and just on and on.
David did a lot. David has a film he's doing now, or has done, called East Side Story.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen it, but I think he's just beginning to promote it now. And Elliot Feld, of course, had his own company in New York for a long, I guess, until not too long ago. And Elliot was a serious ballet person. He had a wonderful technique himself. And Tony Mordente, you're right. There were some significant people that came out of, as choreographers out of West Side as well.
Now, am I mistaken, or was Tony Mordente kind of put in touch of overseeing the choreography after Robbins left?
Right, yeah, he was. Because when we did the show in London, Tony was playing Arab, and he was married to Cheetah at the time, and Lisa was 6 months old.
Wow.
But he was the dance captain, so he oversaw, made sure everything stayed in place, and the film too. Now, one of the things that happened in the dance at the gym, because the dance at the gym had been rehearsed, but none of it had been filmed with Jerry there. So I think it was Tony. I can't remember how that just thought, Russ is an athlete, he can tumble, let's put some of that in for Russ, for Riff. It was such a wonderful thing to do. Tony was had taken over to oversee Jerry's work while he was gone, because Howard Jeffrey, who had been Jerry's assistant from the very beginning, from the show in New York, all through the filming and everything, when Jerry left, Howard left too, because he's just in his heart, he couldn't stay on, because his fidelity to Jerry was that strong,
Did you ever talk to Jerome Robbins about this afterwards? I mean, was he angry about the way it turned out?
I never spoke to him myself, but hey, I can imagine he wasn't too happy. That would have been Walter Mirisch is the one who had to go to Jerry's house with the bad news, and he said it was the worst day of his life.
I can imagine.
Oh. And he said Jerry's immediate reaction was, I'll take my name off the picture. Of course, that didn't happen, because that was an instant kind of...
Sure.
God, that was... I guess... I mean, how can you... get fired, Jerry Robbins, for God's sake. But again, I think, as I said earlier, I think, it was quote unquote safe, because they had a lot already filmed and in the can with Jerry's presence.
Yeah.
So it was like, Okay, maybe, you know, it would be fine without him too, because so much had been rehearsed and so much had been filmed.
And then he and Wise shared an Oscar for this.
So. That's right.
So it did.
Yeah.
It's ironic in a way that.
Yeah.
But you know, an Academy Award for but it, inspired from.
Yeah, sorry. but it's and I'm sure Bob. Bob was very comfortable, I think, in his collaboration with Jerry. I love that I say that because I didn't hear them talk to each other, but they certainly looked that way. Again, for me, I can't imagine this that this film could have been the same if Jerry had not been there. There's just the way we all felt, and I guess when I say we, I'm probably thinking of myself because I can't really know how anybody else felt, but there was this real it wasn't a conscious thought, but desire to want to please him out of loving him and admiring him. And by the way, I never had. I'm one of those people, or I'm sure there are many, who never had any kind of a problem with Jerry ever. I mean, it was Cheetah Rivera says that. She said, "Well, I have not a bad word to say. Nothing." This Jerry's reputation, which I didn't learn about till well after I was already in the play. I did read one of the books on him, the one called Dances with Demons, I think mm-hmm. it's called. And in that book, you know, there are a lot of people who have these Jerry Robbins stories, but it seems that almost all of them said, but I'd work with him again in a second, you know.
Well, you can't be that good unless you're very demanding and very driven. And
yeah.
So probably some people felt like they were driven too hard.
Well, they were driven, everybody was young and you needed that drive. I never heard him ever raise his voice. Jerry was a quiet presence, but when he was there, you felt that just his being. I remember in the morning before we started filming and we were rehearsing, there would be everybody come in, have a quick cup of coffee, and then do a warm up before rehearsal started, and Jerry was not there for any of that, and then tiny little bit break and then Jerry came in quietly, and it was, to me, I was like, when he came in, there was electricity in the room. He didn't act like, it was just his presence just changed the atmosphere, but in a wonderful way. That story that and he said it to us in the London company, that cast that we rehearsed in New York. But the very first day of rehearsal, we gathered in a semicircle around him. He said, "Now look, we've got 3 weeks," and he said, "I want the I'm paraphrasing. I want the Sharks to stay over there. I want the Jets to stay over there. I don't want you guys." He really separated them so that, but I. My view of what he wanted to do was to keep that tension. Because if you see West Side Story and it doesn't have the tension, and I've seen those, it doesn't work. So he had a really legitimate reason. I think it really made good sense. It worked. And when we were rehearsing we rehearsed in New York, then we all got on a chartered plane, Stephen Sondheim, all of us on a chartered plane to go to Liverpool. Liverpool? No, not Liverpool. Sorry, wrong city.
To London?
No, God. A very famous city in London, in England, where we... And I should know, it should be on the tip of my tongue, but And we opened at the Opera House, Manchester, at the Opera House in Manchester. But we had some days of rehearsal before we opened. And I guess the tension had built up. And so one day, Jerry didn't hold rehearsal. Arthur Lawrence took over the rehearsal for one day just to give everybody a little breathing space. Because, again, it wasn't Jerry yelling, or because he never raised his voice. It was just, I guess everybody needed that little ease and let up on the tension a little bit. And then, hey, get right back to it. But just a little break, you know. But then I remember opening night in London, we're all, he brought everybody, called on everybody on stage, and he gave a really sort of pep talk kind of thing. And I remember just, I just felt really a sheer, beautiful sort of love for this man, because I don't know, maybe I just sort of felt, I can't say how, I just admired him so, he was fantastic, you know, just so amazing. But the tension that built up, and I'm sure when they were shooting Cool as well, there was problem. But it's necessary. It's necessary. You don't have to be. There's Jaime Rogers, who's so wonderful in West Side. But Jaime Rogers, for example, now he's been a dance teacher for quite some time. And for example, this thing of sometimes not treating people well. I'd always heard about Jaime that he always makes one girl cry. And one day I went, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, I went and took one of his classes. And sure enough, he made one girl cry. And but this, so people earn their reputations, and I suppose Jerry's reputation for being tight was earned, but it was all valid, I think. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now I went to see the Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm a few months ago.
Uh huh.
And you and Rita Moreno and Russ Tamblyn were all there together.
Oh yes, right.
So it occurs to me, did you all just maintain your friendship all these years?
We have. Yeah.
Is that how you met these two? I mean, had you worked together?
No, we all met on West Side Story, yeah. And we all remained, all of us, it's like a family. And even with Bob, Bob said, of all the films he's made, it was the only one where he remained friendly with his cast. The girls, some of the girls, the girls are great at getting people together. Gina Tricconis and Rita Hyde and Carol Dandrea, and all of them would get together and invite take Bob to lunch. So he really appreciated this family feeling, and it's still there. And sometimes when I see a theater production of it and I'm sitting watching it, it's just more people who are part of the family, you know. It's it's just one of those pieces that kind of does that. But definitely, Russ and Rita and I, not just a couple of weeks ago, Rita was in town with and Fran Drescher. She and Fran Drescher were given honors by, what is it, the Women's Natural History Museum. And but again, Rita asked me if I would introduce her, so I did, and I got, so we see each other. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it is great.
Yeah, it doesn't happen all that much in this business, does it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Before we move on from West Side Story, I wanted to ask you about your Oscar experience. You are my first Academy Award winner on this show.
Well.
And I watched, you can see them on YouTube, they're your acceptance speech and Rita's, and I was struck by, it looks like the same clip, because you're both sitting together in the audience.
We went together, yeah.
And so when one is announced as the winner, you hug and then get up, and then the next time when the others announce the winner, you hug and she gets up.
Yes, right, right.
It's like the same clip.
Yeah.
But tell me about that, because Fred Astaire gave you your Oscar.
No, Shirley Jones gave
me. Oh, Shirley Jones.
Shirley
yeah.
Jones. But
yeah, Fred Astaire gave the Best Picture.
That's
but,
right.
The West Side Story.
And
Best
hey,
Picture Oscar, yeah.
I'm such a fiendish admirer of Fred Astaire.
For sure.
I thought, my God, how wonderful that he, you know, gave that award. So perfect, so perfect. You know, let's see. The nominations didn't come out. They were later then in the year, maybe. But Russ and Richard and I went to with Bob Wise to the national. No, I'm sorry, the Royal Command performance of West Side Story in Her Majesty the Queen, you know, at the Leicester Square Theater. And we all rented our tails, and there were lots of wonderful people in the audience. And of course, the Queen, of course, was there, you know. It was a great experience. But at that evening, there was an intermission. And during the intermission, we went up to a room in the theater somewhere, and Bob Wise, during that intermission, was on the phone to the West Coast, and that's when he got the news of the nominations, and that's when he told me
wow.
that I was nominated. That's when I first heard anything about that. I don't remember what I thought, but I guess I probably thought, well, that's nice. and then going to the Oscars with Rita was. She's so funny. The car came to pick me up first, and then we went to her place and picked her up. And either in the car before she got in the car, she said, "I'm practicing my loser's face." Anne Margaret did a number at that night, and I remember. And we were busy, so we saw her on the monitor, and Rita looked up and she said, "That girl's going to be a star." She's wonderful. So we had it was an incredible evening. Just a great, and the thing that made it so wonderful is we went together. We were both honored, you know, and it was perfect. It was just perfect. And it was a beautiful, beautiful night. The next year, Rita and I were both presenters, and so car came and picked me up, and then it picked her up. In those days, the awards were at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, and we were in this shiny new Lincoln limousine, whatever it was, and going down Wilshire Boulevard, the electrical system on the car stopped. It just had to keep going till it came to a stop. Unfortunately, nothing happened. And we thought, well, what do we do? How do we get there, you know? So we called a cab. And I thought to myself, if you want to be totally ignored when you arrive at the Academy Awards, go in a yellow cab, you know?
But that must have been a thrill. I can't even imagine what it's like.
Yeah.
And especially so early in your movie career. I mean, that's...
Well, West Side was my first movie. I mean, I danced in the chorus of movies and loved every minute of that. I was really naive. And, you know, people think in terms of... what this will do for their career, and I never thought that way because I didn't know that. Just think of it. Although I think the people around me did to some degree, but it was you just knew it was something extra special and wonderful, and that feeling was just great. And then. Again, and then this, you know, getting the Oscar, and then Russ and Rita and I did our footprints at Grauman's.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's wild, isn't it? It's just wild. Yeah.
So, how did it change your career? Did you did you get any more power over the kinds of roles that you were offered? Or
well, I certainly could have, but I didn't know it. But before I finished working on West Side, when I finished, I went back into to the play in London, playing Riff, and I loved getting back to the theater again. That was great. But the Mirisch people signed me to a 5-picture deal, and my first movie after West Side Story was not with them, but I didn't know that I could, that I had any control. I was a chorus dancer, you know, just going from one job to the next.
Sure.
So when I think back, I thought, God, I wish I'd been smarter, you know. But no, I didn't think that at all. Yeah. Although there were a couple of times, there were a couple of movies that I instinctively, for whatever reason, didn't want to make. One of them was a movie called Kings of the Sun. For mm-hmm. the,
I said it in Mexico, right?
Yes, and just I just did not want to be in this movie, you know. But my contract with them was pay or play. So on a certain date, if they don't use you, they have to pay you anyway. Well, nobody wants to pay you for nothing, right?
Sure.
So they put me in this film, and nobody around me thought, well, let's, you know, forget this date. Let's, you know, find something different.
Yeah.
But so, and I didn't think to say that. I probably could have. I just didn't think of it. So I pretty much went, I'll say, with the flow, with a couple of exceptions. When, although I ended up having to do that film, and I'm not sorry. It's really interesting because I get a lot of really nice reaction to that movie. People mm-hmm. really love it. Working with Yul was great, and I'd worked with him once before, and so I did have a nice time. And Shirley Ann Field was just so darling, so wonderful. You know, when I look back, I'm really not sorry about anything. There's only one thing that happened in my career that I'm still sorry about. And this thing of having, you know, control and of your own fate, so to speak. After I did West Side, I was signed by the William Morris office, and Lenny Hirshhorn was my contact there, and Julie Shar was the head of the department for personal appearances and things like that. And Julie introduced me to a woman whose name is Ruth Ahrens. And Ruth represented Shirley Jones, and anyway, so I signed on with Ruth, and I had a lot of really nice times with her. But I gave her power of attorney. What did I know? She wanted a power of attorney, and I said, "Oh yeah, yeah." And here's the thing that I wish I could go back and change. And I think it's the only thing. When I was working on the Young Girls of Rochefort in France, I had occasion to talk to Ruth on the phone, something to do with a movie, I don't remember what. And then when we finished talking, because I had signed a recording contract with Capitol Records, and I had made 4 albums so far. And at the end of our conversation, she said, oh, by the way, I've canceled your Capitol contract. Well, it went over my head because I was thinking about the movie.
Yeah.
She canceled this contract. She didn't go to another label or anything. She just brought it to an end. And, of course, Capitol wanted to renew my contract. She just didn't like any of the producers. I mean, she was... But that was such a serious, serious mistake.
Yeah.
That's a regret. That really is. Because I love singing, music, recordings. I mean, it's music. It's...
Sure.
It's also great. And she just brought it to an end, you know. If I had thought, I could have said, okay, well, let's go somewhere. But I didn't. I wasn't savvy enough to know that I could do that. Yeah.
It seems like a very strange time to do something like that. I mean, if you're making a musical again,
yeah.
It seems like that would put...
yeah. Well, it was...
very strange.
It was a bad thing to do. And I've since spoken to... You know, so many people in the business, you know, you hear a lot of stories about people with their business managers and stealing and all this kinds of things. But very often these people do want a power of attorney. Now, Ruth was not my business manager, but, and by the way, I had some wonderful times with her. She was great and we had a lot of fun, but this was a mistake. Sometimes with the Q&A, with younger people, if I ever have the chance, I'll say, well, just never give anyone power of attorney, because it's not a good thing to do.
I want to talk about Young Girls of Rochefort, but first I want to backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
And talk about some of your adventures as a chorus dancer. I mean, obviously, you're in one of the most famous musical numbers of all time. Yeah. The Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Yes,
from Gentlemen for Blondes.
Yeah.
I'm real curious about everybody involved.
Okay.
But we'll start with Jack Cole. Really interesting choreographer.
Mm.
And in that film, it's such distinctive movements for everybody. As a matter of fact, what he does with Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell is unlike any other choreography I've ever seen with anybody. They do these tiny little movements and raise a shoulder or raise an eyebrow.
Yeah.
Just these minuscule little things.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they'll just go into, it looks like they're doing stripper moves or something, but it's a real interesting guy. So obviously Howard Hawks is directing the film,
right?
But I would imagine that you would have worked with Jack Cole more than with Howard Hawks.
Yeah,
right?
Howard Hawks was never around when the number was filmed.
Really,
Jack Cole conceived, choreographed, and directed.
Wow,
that thing. He was on the camera, not during takes, but he was on the camera for the shot. And Howard Hawks wasn't around because he knew he could leave it to Jack Cole. I'm so glad you mentioned Jack Cole because he's just so fantastic.
Yeah.
Jack deserves to be as well known as Jerry Robbins or anybody else, but because he was extraordinary, because he designed the set, he had probably had a lot to say about costumes. There was always a great one, for example, in Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, it's a red background, a red background, beautiful.
That is one of the most Technicolor films ever made.
Right. Yeah. And she's in a pink dress, and the guys are in black. Now, you go back to the I Don't Care Girl, mm-hmm. with Mitzi Gaynor, which was Jack Cole. The background was yellow, all yellow, and there were steps. Free, kind of floating in the air that she had to go down, it wasn't a built set. I'm describing this really badly, but he laid a really clear, beautiful background for movement,
yeah.
And that's one of the things. And then his movement, Jack's choreography was just amazing. Just all the dancers in town, they couldn't wait to work for Jack Cole. And by the way, Marilyn Monroe didn't want anybody else but him. And even Jane Russell, what he does for her. And he does so much. There's always humor.
Yeah.
In his numbers, those little double entendre things, but they're funny. They're delicious. He had a reputation for being a taskmaster, and the only thing I remember during rehearsal of that number was all the guys were rehearsing that step they would do behind her at one point, and he was sitting on the chair, the mirror facing us, and out of the blue, I guess he thought nobody was doing it right. Out of the blue, he gets up and goes bam, 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 and demonstrates this step. And how did he do that? He didn't even warm up, you know. When you walked into the room and you're going to audition or work for Jack Cole, you were a little on edge too, you know. But he was It was just fantastic. I mean, you could go on and on, just spend a long time just talking about him. And the nice thing, it's always nice if you can, in talking about him, to make reference to some of his work. I was always a great fan of Betty Grable, no matter what she did, because she was wonderful in anything. And the Fox musicals were not the best, you know. But her best...
great numbers in them, though.
Yeah, but she did a movie called Meet Me After the Show.
Yeah.
Jack Cole. She finally had a really wonderful choreographer, and boy, could she dance! I mean, she did everything. She was so delicious to watch, and she was. But again, Jack Cole, her. She finally had somebody that was worthy of her. You know, yeah, it's great.
What about Marilyn? You get so many stories about how much trouble she was on the set and all this stuff. What was your memory of working with her?
Well, it took 3 days to shoot it till 9 o'clock on the third day. Not an ounce of temperament anywhere. No, never. And whenever there was a, she was very quiet. And whenever there was a cut for any reason, she didn't look in the mirror. She didn't go to her dressing room. She went right back to her starting position. Start again. She was just deeply concentrated, a wonderful worker. I think she really cared really deeply about her work. She loved Jack. But on Diamonds Are Girls' Best Friend, she was there on time. I mean, and working is as hard, if not harder. Hey, the bottom line is it all fell on her shoulders, you know. So, nothing but praise for her. And she was, I was around her a few other, a few other times, and it was always the same. She was always quiet. She never walked in like a, you know, she was not gregarious, and she was quiet. And, but when she was around, everything else disappeared, you know. But she was a wonderful worker. I do remember when she was the one thing, the only other thing, we've all heard the stories about her being late. And, but the only time I ever sort of saw it was when she was doing No Business Like Show Business with, and there was a number, the Lazy number, with Mitzi Gaynor and Donald O'Connor. And one day, she wasn't ready till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that couldn't have been too great for Mitzi and Donald. But hey, the thing is, when she was there, something happened, you know. Yeah.
As people spend so much time talking about her personal life.
Yes, right.
That I think she's still, oddly enough, I think she's still underrated as a performer.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's right, because people just repeat all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't, I mean, for example, the dumb blonde or whatever. I mean, she played a dumb/smart blonde in Gentlemen for Blondes. But she created a character. She created Laura Lee, you know, and that's not who she was in life, and that's not how she was in her other movies either. So you're right. We really have to focus to be fair to her, to recognize what an enormous talent she was. And I think she was a huge talent.
Sure. And that Jack Cole choreography is difficult. I mean, I'm clearly not a dancer.
Yeah.
But I know dancing when I see it. And that, is not easy stuff to do.
No.
And so it takes a level of skill to do what she was doing.
She was musically gifted.
Yeah.
She sang well. She knew how to do, and she moved beautifully. When she and Jane Russell are doing the "We're Just Two Little" the opening song,
Two Little Girls from Little Rock.
You're right. You can see little impulses that are just hers. You know, it's a gift.
Yeah,
it's a gift. She moved That's great.
Yeah, that's the number that's most baffling to me in terms of choreography, because it's just, they do things and I think, how in the world do you even remember to do all that in sequence?
It's
really astonishing stuff.
Well, yeah, and again, there's one, and in that one, and there's just two girls from Little Rock. The more you see it, the more I notice something that Jack called. And there's one where Marilyn is singing, and she just does, she pulls her dress as a little move. I thought, who would think of that?
Yeah.
Who would think of Jack Cole?
And that number is filled with stuff like that.
Yes, it's
these tiny little gestures that like you say, who would even come up with it at all?
Right. Yeah.
Amazing. I last saw you in person at a screening of Young Girls of Rochefort,
right, yeah,
which is also a movie I could watch every day of my life. I think it's just so wonderful. I mean, just the whole feeling of that.
Yes.
So, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in that, and let's talk about your experiences there.
Well, let's see. I met Jacques Demy and Michel Legrandre. They came to the house, and they had, everything in that film. I'm sorry, all the music had been pre-recorded. They already had it was pre-recorded.
Even the vocals.
Yes, even the vocals. And the only person who sang, I'm never sure about Gene, because I know Gene sang and probably did sing for himself. But everybody else was dubbed, including me and Grover, and except for Danielle Darieux, who of course was a singer. That was her voice. This darling, sweet, beautiful voice. And I remember kind of liking the sound of it, Ruth and Lenny Hirsch on William Morris, they said, well, George, it's an ensemble film. Why would you want to do an ensemble film? But thank God I went ahead and did it.
Sure.
Because I love that movie too. I think it's such a lovely film. And by the way, there's a couple of, you can see influence from Jack Cole in that movie and from West Side Story. He has a quintet in this movie. And also the girls, Catherine and Françoise, when they're doing their number, it's all in broad daylight, but then red sequin, we're just two little girls from Little Rock. So, Jacques Demy did that. He would take, if he really liked what he saw and was influenced by it and really admired it, he would, I guess, sometimes try to incorporate it in some way. There's a film that he directed with Jean Moreau. It's in black and white. I can't remember what it's called. And she's got long blonde hair in it. And in that, I was told that the dress, it's kind of a jacket and a skirt that she wears, and that is absolutely the same outfit or one of them that Marilyn Monroe wore in The Misfits. So he was a fan of Marilyn Monroe. I assume he was, because those little bits and pieces, he there was an influence.
Well, he wanted to make Young Girls of Rochefort to be a little like a Hollywood musical.
Right.
Although, in fact, it's not much like a Hollywood musical.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think I always assumed that that's why you're there, that's why Gene Kelly's there, to bring this Hollywood magic into France.
Yeah, he really, really wanted Gene. I mean, I know he wanted me, but really, and Gene. And I think you're right, because he brought dance into the film, it expanded. It was a bigger film in that way. I remember, during lunch or dinner or something of that one, that most of it was in French. But I think Jacques he was doing something he was very proud of, with every right to be proud. He was wonderful. He's one of really creative, I'm sure if he were still here today, he would have moved on to have done even more. So it did have that Hollywood musical kind of thing, and I think he that's why he used Gene and me, and then Grover, Grover Dale, but that French cast was fantastic.
Were you already? Could you speak French?
Not much. At that, I've learned more since then. But so, what we
did
had
you learn
to
learn phonetically, or
we had to learn it phonetically. Yeah. Yes, and that's how we learned it. I remember one morning, Grover, before shooting, Grover and I were going over lines, and Catherine came by, and she kind of laughed because she could hear us really working on our French. You know, they were sweet. Those girls, just wonderful. But
probably two of the most beautiful women who ever existed, and Catherine Deneuve remains one of the most beautiful women.
Absolutely.
And Françoise died very soon after filming.
Maybe a year later, she was killed in a
terrible.
Yeah, it is, and she was what a darling.
Yeah.
But Catherine, I mean, just. So beautiful. And the first day of filming, when they, you know, they applied just a little bit of makeup, and she walked out, and she was just breathtaking. Just flawlessly, breathtakingly beautiful. And the great thing about Françoise and Catherine is they were so great with each other. They really loved each other, and you could see it. It was great.
Almost all of that film is shot outdoors. What were the situation there with, did they just clear out the town? And, I mean, it's mostly in a couple of locations.
Right.
But almost everything is shot outside.
You're right.
And their little coffee shop is completely surrounded with windows.
Right. Well, there was the square in the center of the town, and they built the coffee shop on the square, and then the music shop was like over here somewhere. They've taken one of the buildings there and just redone it for the music shop beautifully. The only things that were, well, I guess you'd say the coffee shop was indoors. The girl's apartment was indoors, and the music shop was indoors. That's it. You're right. Everything else was outdoors, but maybe because of the location of Rochefort, maybe there wasn't a lot of air traffic over it or something. I don't think things like that happened. And if they did, it was probably rare. I don't remember ever having to wait till the noise was gone, till they could start shooting again. It was quiet, a quiet town.
And so you speak almost no dialogue. It's almost always sung. And so, that was all pre-recorded anyway.
Yes.
Right? So you were just performing to playback.
That's right. Yeah. All of us performed to playback. Yes, because everybody's voice, as I said, was pre-recorded, except for Danielle Dario. Yeah, you just, that was part of doing it, was learning to learn it. And the way I sort of almost remember the songs now.
Yeah.
But for the dialogue, what they really wanted us to do, to speak as quickly as we could, because French people speak quickly, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that was the one thing they asked us to try and do, because we spoke French, and then they were dubbed afterwards. The musical numbers were done in English and in French. So every musical number was done twice.
They just wanted to be ready for an English-speaking audience? Is that they just wanted to prepare another?
I think so. And there was an English version. I think it didn't work. You know, it's French. There's such charm in the French dialogue that to get that same charm in English is probably really hard to do. I remember Because somewhere I have an LP of the English English recording, it was okay, but it wasn't. It didn't hold a candle to the to the French version. Yeah.
So. How long was Gene Kelly around? I get the feeling that he was there much shorter than the rest of you were.
He was what? Sorry.
That he was there for a shorter time than
let's see.
The rest of you, because his part is not huge.
Right. Yeah. I don't remember. Gosh, how long he was there. He and Kathleen and Francoise and I and Grover stayed in a town called Fouras, which is like a 15-minute drive, in a house that had been converted into like a small kind of hotel. One day, his wife at that time, Jeannie Coyne, I got a letter from her, a very sweet letter, and a can of corned beef hash. She said, because his birthday was coming up, and she wanted to surprise him with his favorite breakfast, which was, you know, ham and eggs, and not ham and corned beef hash. So we did that for him. The cook and the place was great, and it was simple enough to. And for a moment, he thought she was there, you know. So, but anyway, that was fun. He was, I think, you know, if anybody knows musical film, it's Gene Kelly. And I did not watch any of the filming of his dance sequences, but I heard that he was having not trouble, but he has some disagreement with Jacques, because Jacques, when Gene Kelly did a musical, he knew exactly where that camera was going to be before they ever started filming. Jacques didn't work that way. He was going to do it in the editing room and decide. So there were these longer takes, and evidently Gene would say, but you can't use it from that, you know, that kind of thing. He's such an icon, you know.
Well, Kelly was a director as well as a choreographer.
That's
and
right.
a dancer. And
yeah.
Well, he was everything. You
yeah.
an actor, a singer,
yes.
you name it.
Yeah.
So he, yes, certainly he knew how to shoot a number,
yeah.
if anybody ever did.
Absolutely, yeah.
And now, did you work with him at all on Brigadoon? The number that you're in, is he...
Well, I
it's been so long since I've seen that.
I was in the chorus of Brigadoon,
yeah.
So come ye to the square, that big thing. I'm in there somewhere. And then there's the sword dance, which is is cut from the film. But I was one of the... I think there were four of us, and Gene directed that, so I was one of the four guys who worked for him during the sword dance in Brigadoon. He was great. He was just wonderful. And that was my only time around him. I remember when we first said hello in Rochefort. No, we met first in London. We rehearsed in London. And he said, gee, it'd be nice if we could do something together. But, you know, that was storyline didn't allow, and I'm sure Jacques probably wouldn't have done it anyway, because in his mind, this thing was in place, pre-recorded everything. So I don't think Jacques would have gone for that anyway. I didn't work with him at all. I remember he was sort of putting it off, you know, like, yeah, I better start rehearsing or something. but that's because he probably knew already what he was going to do.
You're going to be showing this at UCLA when? Next week?
A week from today.
They're calling that an evening with George Takei.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
I'm scared.
It should be fun. I will definitely come and see it. I could, as I said, I could watch that film again and again.
It is a lovely film.
Well, that's an honor to give you an evening at UCLA.
I'm not sure how that happened. maybe it was the people. Deborah Levine, who's the dance critic for the LA Times, I think she, with them, decided to do this. I think. I can't think of how else it might have happened. And it, you know, it's one night, but at the same time, it's a big deal.
Sure.
Know? I mean, in the sense that you hope it'll be good. But the one of the things that I'm reminded of is, don't worry, George. The last thing they're doing is showing the movie, so it'll be okay.
Yes, everybody will leave on an up note.
Right. It's going to be a long evening because the movie is over 2 hours long, I think.
Yeah.
But
it's over 2 hours good, too.
Yes. So. Yeah.
Well, we should be wrapping up pretty soon, but what I wanted to make sure we talked about your current business, your jewelry business.
Oh.
Give me a little bit of background on how you got started on that.
Yeah, well... let's see, about 1999, I think it was. I was doing a play in London. I most of the work in the night, well, not just the 90s, but most of the things I did were, or at least a good portion of them were done out of the country, movies as well. But I was just away from home a lot. And I had a little dog, a little Italian greyhound, beautiful. His name was Sammy. I'd take Sammy for a walk around the block. The little kids would, a couple of called him Bambi. Well, and I came back from doing this play, and I looked at Sammy. I mean, this sounds like a stupid... I looked at Sammy and I thought, you know, 8, 9, 10 months is a long time out of his life. I'm going to stay home. I'm just going to stay here and be with Sammy. So I just took time off, and then... and then just by, I don't remember how I even started, but I started taking silversmithing classes at Barnsall over on, what is it, Vermont and Hollywood. And it just kind of sort of took over a little bit, but it was perfect because I have a freestanding garage that I turned into a studio, so I could get up and take Sammy for a walk and then go to the garage and work, and he could come and be with me if he wanted to. So it was a perfect setup. But the reason I started was because of him. But then, little by little, with time, I developed over time what is called a collection. I work with a manufacturer downtown, and there was a Japanese distributor about 5 years ago, something like that, that I also knew this manufacturer downtown. And I met him, showed him some of my stuff, and he just bought a lot of stuff. So that was my first sort of professional thing where, well, hey, maybe I can make some money from this, you know, because I wasn't thinking that way at all. But it started because of my little Italian greyhound, Sammy. And now, I'm more interested in this collection, because right now there are a couple of situations that look really promising. You never know. If they happen, it would just be, you know, I could sort of be on the map in a serious way. So I hope that'll happen. But even if it doesn't, the way I, my real reason for doing it to begin with was because of my little Sammy. But the other reason was, as with time, I loved doing it. It was so gratifying to imagine a piece and then find a way to make it, and then when it's all finished and polished and shiny and looking beautiful, and to hold it in your hand, and look, there's a real
sure.
gratification in that, you know, it's an accomplishment, and it's kind of art, you know, it's, I think, in the world, it's in the art world in some way too, so it's creative, I've really, hey, it has its frustrating points too, but bottom line is I've really had a good time with it, and am having a good time with it, and when I think of Sammy, I just think, hey, Sammy, this is for you.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to work on something that is yours alone, that nobody's given you notes on, and you're
right. Yeah.
And so the product is yours.
Yeah, and the other thing that's nice about it, I'm basically not the product. You know, it's something else.
Yeah.
So that kind of pressure is not there.
Well, we'll put the website on my website.
Okay.
I have a links page, and we'll also have links to a lot of your movies and so forth. So
yeah,
people can click through to Amazon and get those as well. And everybody will be happy.
Everybody, yeah, right, yeah.
Well, I am particularly happy that you consented to do this.
Yeah.
This has been such fun for me, and we've been trying to do it for quite a while.
Yeah, well, I hope I've been helpful to you in some way, about West Side and so on, because, in all of this time, before West Side, during West Side, and after West Side, I've been able to travel, I've worked with wonderful people, and I've gotten to know a lot of wonderful. It's such an amazing business that way, because it really is about people.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's been really nice, most of the time.
Well, your work has meant a great deal to me for as long as I can remember, so this is a very big deal for me to talk to you, and I appreciate it very much, and I enjoyed it very much.
Okay, thank you, Frank, because I knew I'd have a good time talking to you.
Everybody has a good time talking to you. You'd be surprised. So, thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I hope that I'll get to talk to him again someday, because I really enjoyed that chat. As I told him, I will put a link to his page, although it's easy enough to remember, georgechakiris.com, which will lead you to his jewelry business. And I'll also post several of his movies on DVD and related things on his page on the commentary track when this is posted. And you can go through and order them through Amazon. And if you go through my site, then I'll get a little bit of a kickback, and God bless you. Since Christmas is coming up, I also want to urge you to go to my book page or my videos page and buy things from there that will be the perfect Christmas gift for your film-loving friends. I have a couple of very specific things, the Great Christmas Movies book and also Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas book, which I wrote. And if you can order that one through the Amazon link on my page, and you can order the Great Christmas Movies book directly from me, and I will autograph it if you wish. So I hope that you'll consider doing that, because that would really be nice for me. And if you buy it from me, then the person you give it to will have a Merry Christmas, and I will have a Merry Christmas. And that, as the bard would say, is a consummation devoutly to be wished. Let me say thanks to my wonderful, beautiful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. To the probably equally beautiful, although I've never seen him in person, James Hutchins, who designed my website. Both of them, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. As always, I really want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music for and aft. And I want to thank you for spreading the word about the commentary track. That is the only way we can get new listeners. I don't know how you advertise a podcast. All you can do is just get people to tell other people to listen in. So I urge you to do that, and urge you to go to iTunes and leave a nice review. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, please do so on iTunes. Even if you download it from the website, it would still help me out just in terms of numbers if you went to iTunes and subscribed. This is free, and it doesn't put you on any mailing list or anything, and all it can do is help me out, and I would appreciate that. So, got another great guest coming up next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.